The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. With us this week is Blair Horner. Boy, do I love Blair Horner. He is one smart man and knows more about New York State government and politics than anybody I know. He's the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, otherwise known as NYPIRG. Welcome, Blair.
I'm happy to be here, Alan. Good to talk to you.
So, New York holds a primary in a pandemic. 1.7 million New Yorkers requested a ballot, more than 10 times the number requested in 2016, the last year for a presidential primary. So how did New York's first effort at mail-in voting go? Not great?
Yeah, not so great. I mean, everybody who was eligible to vote in the primary, Democrats or Republicans, depending where they lived, was sent an absentee ballot under an edict issued by the governor. But there were lots of complaints. We heard lots of complaints of people who submitted their request for an absentee ballot and didn't get the ballot in time. That was the number one complaint we heard everywhere in the state. So under New York's system, you file an absentee ballot request, then you get the ballot in the mail, and then you can mail in your ballot. And it had to be postmarked on primary day, June 23rd. And the single biggest complaint was that people weren't getting the weren't getting their ballots in time. I heard it across the state. It was a big problem everywhere. So that was a big problem. Some of the mechanics of when you then had to go to the polling place, poll workers weren't necessarily trained. In some parts of the state, there was a ballot was on two sides and people were only getting one side of it. They didn't know what was going on. So there was a certain amount of chaos that you always sort of expect. But the added element of the mail-in ballots, I think, created even more angst. People who were requesting an affidavit ballot so that they didn't have to go to the polls ended up having to go to the polls if they wanted to vote. And that was a big problem.
And they had better have been wearing a mask.
That's right. And so should the poll workers. I mean, one of the things that this sort of underscored in having an election in the pandemic is a weakness in the system generally, which is every election, there needs to be poll workers there and they need to be Democrat, Republican, observer, then all these folks. So who can sit there all day and help people sign in and direct them to their machine and all the questions that can come up? They generally tend to be older New Yorkers and often retirees. And in a pandemic, that's very tricky to get those people because they're the group most at risk of the coronavirus. And so it underscored some of the difficulties in our system. It's always a hard time recruiting poll workers in the first place. It's a lot harder in a pandemic, particularly one where the virus is targeting older New Yorkers.
So Blair Horner, there'll be other chances at this to make it right. I mean, we're going to have a presidential election, correct?
That's right. I mean, it'll be a lot worse, a lot more. The potential exists for it to be a lot worse in November. Hopefully, New York will have learned the lessons of this experience. It's not clear what's going to happen with these absentee ballots. Technically, under the state constitution, you have to have an excuse, a legitimate excuse for why you're requesting an absentee ballot. You're sick or you have to travel somewhere for work and you have no choice. The governor in his edict said, well, we're going to consider the definition of illness to include being exposed to the coronavirus. Therefore, you can get an absentee automatically. And that's how they did it mechanically. It's not clear what's going to happen this November with regard to that. You add to that the problem of the poll workers. It's also compounded by the early voting, right? So in this past election, people could vote in advance of primary day, The same thing will happen in the general in November. And so you need more workers to make all that happen. And if the pandemic is raging this fall, the whole system is going to have some serious problems unless steps are taken between now and October to sort of make it as easy as possible for people to vote. Our choice would be, of course, that you make the system of mailing in the vote the easiest possible option for voters.
Now, Blair Horner, we do have a record budget deficit here, $16 billion. The governor keeps holding out and saying the feds have to make us good on that. Meantime, a lot of people are holding their breath. School districts are holding their breath. Everybody is. It could be a 20% reduction in the money they get. That's a lot of teachers who are going to get fired. What do you make of this?
Well, the state started the beginning of this calendar year with a $6 billion deficit,
right,
which has, as you just correctly pointed out, mushroomed to a much larger size. It affects local governments. The state is withholding money from local governments right now. They're withholding money from not-for-profits. Some are on the verge of collapse. Organizations that provide services that the government doesn't, but the government pays them to do it, and they're withholding the money. I think the strategy, the political calculus on the governor's part, is to kick the can and hope that the feds pony up some dough this month that can help the state at least limp through the remainder of the calendar year and going into next fiscal year. But that's, you know, that's the hope. But that doesn't deal with the recurring deficits. I mean, the governor's estimating that the budget deficit over the next 6 years, next 4 years combined, will be over $60 billion, 6-0. And you're going to have to come up with revenues to do that because the state can ill afford to have 20% cuts across the board in healthcare and education. It just doesn't work.
So
I think
answer?
One of the big fights, you know, one of the big fights is going to be, how do you raise the revenue?
Sure.
And, you know, the cuts affect people that were delivering essential services at the height of the pandemic. People that rely on healthcare from the government, rely on public education from the government. We don't think that those are the people that should bear the burden in terms of cuts. It should be that the wealthiest individuals pick up the tab. And one of the ways to do that, there's one sort of odd tax that the state has called a stock transfer tax,
right,
which has been on the books for over 100 years. The state doesn't collect the money. They give it right back to Wall Street. We think they should keep the money, and that would go a long way to dealing with the budget deficit.
What if the stock exchange says, okay, if you do that, we move?
That's what they say all the time. But, yeah, you know, I mean, I think moving Wall Street from lower Manhattan to New Jersey would be more expensive for Wall Street than it would be just to pay the tax. A lot of other places have these kind of financial transfer taxes. Singapore, Berlin, London, they all have it. It's a sort of a common way that governments pay for themselves. It's like a sales tax. You pay for a tiny, tiny fraction of a sale of a stock or a purchase of a stock. It's just like if you go to the store. And yet when you're looking at who does a lot of that kind of trading, the high frequency traders, the speculators, they're the ones who would feel the tax, not Blair Horner, who doesn't do anything on Wall Street, or Alan Chartok. Well, maybe Alan Chartok does.
Maybe
I don't
a
know.
Little,
but
yeah.
Blair
maybe.
Doesn't. But it's no. The tax is not even a penny per transaction. But in the high frequency guys would end up paying more. And those speculators are the people that make Wall Street more of a casino than an investment anyway.
So does the governor agree to this or not?
Well, so far he has said he hasn't said anything about doing it other than he's concerned that Wall Street might move to New Jersey, to Hoboken or something. There are court cases that are in place where the state could still collect the tax even if Wall Street did move some of its activities out of the city of New York. So we think it makes perfect sense to do it. Obviously, it would be better if the federal government did it, but New York State should do it. State needs the money. It's got to come from somewhere. And the alternative are deep cuts into important social programs.
So from time to time, I ask you the same question I'm going to ask you again. Is the Republican Party in New York State an endangered species?
Well, every time you ask, the situation gets worse for them, I suppose. The stampede of incumbent state senators out the door this year is sort of surprising to me. The Senate Minority Leader, the former Majority Leader, John Flanagan, has packed it in already. And so obviously they won't be an endangered species because there's large parts of New York that are where the Republicans have a big enrollment advantage. Whether or not they can seize control of either house or for statewide office, which they, it's going to be very hard for them to do that. I think part of it is the unpopularity of the president. And then part of it is they're going to have to come up with a rationale that appeals to independent voters because they have a 2-to-1 enrollment disadvantage in New York State. Republicans do to Democrats. And the swing will be the independent voters. And so to change their sort of their narrative in a way that appeals to independents is going to be critically important. And whatever happens with the president right now, I think in 2020, Republicans are going to be swimming with a cinder block around their neck in New York, given the unpopularity of the president.
It's a huge problem that they have. Their chairman, the GOP chairman, Nick Langworthy, said this week that the governor's expanded pandemic powers should be rolled back. What do you think?
He's right.
What are the expanded powers that trouble you?
Well, I mean, to begin with, New York State's governor is one of the most powerful in the country with regard to what the Constitution gives him, in this case, powers to do. Through the budget process, he has enormous ability to influence policymaking, even if it has very little to do with the budget. Since then, as part of the pandemic response, the legislature ceded to the governor even greater authority to essentially enact laws without the legislature. And the legislature has the power to override what the governor does, but he has unfettered authority, essentially unfettered authority from now until April of next year to issue edicts on anything he wants. As the pandemic has subsided in New York, the legislature, which is supposed to be a co-equal branch of government, should have the authority to do its job and should come back to Albany to do its job. You know, getting more power from the governor only works if the legislature is working. And so it's a sort of a combined thing. But the governor has vast authorities that were ceded to him by the legislature. We think the legislature should take it back. And the legislature should get back to work dealing with the people's business.
Okay, now, obviously, NYPIRG, which you head, has a big investment in our universities and colleges. Many of the members of NYPIRG come from those places. How much danger are they in right now? I keep hearing different stories about whether the students are being invited back, whether they're not going to be back. How bad are things?
Yeah, I mean, it's not clear, depending on the institution you're talking about. Some of the schools in SUNY and some of the independent colleges have said they're going to come back and not have essentially any breaks for the fall semester until Thanksgiving. And then the students would leave the physical presence of the schools and take their finals and prepare for their finals remotely. I've heard that. I've heard hybrid classes where half the class shows up in a classroom and the other half participates remotely. And then on another day, they flip as to who's in and who's out. How they're going to do with how they're going to deal with dormitories is, you know, I hear things, but I think what is college administrators across the, certainly across the country, but in New York, are trying to figure all these things out. And I think they're trying to make those decisions at the last possible minute because no one knows what's going to happen with the pandemic. And obviously things look better in New York now than they did 2 months ago. But a lot of schools, for example, a lot of independent schools, particularly the big universities, have students that come in from all around the country and to some extent around the world. And so how would they do that if the state, for example, is telling them that they can't, or they have to be quarantined when they first get here? And there's a whole bunch of series of technical problems that no one has ever faced. And we're hoping that the school's open because I think it's an important experience for you, particularly young adults, to get. But I think at the moment, we're still in sort of the fog of war aspect of this, where no one really knows how this is going to play out, and they can't see what's going to happen, essentially, in 2 months.
Now, what about the rest of the schools, elementary and secondary education? I know that there's been cancellations. What are you hearing?
Yeah, I'm hearing the same thing. I mean, again, I think it's the same story, which is, how do you plan for something when you don't know what's going to be happening in 2 months? And yet, if you don't have an effective response to K-12 education, it's hard to imagine how the rest of the economy can really open up. And no one knows. Just to go back to the higher education for a second, the UUP, which is the Union of Faculty Professors, has laid out standards which they would like to see for any campus to open up. I assume that New York State United Teachers, which is the parent of the university professors and covers faculty K-12, have the same thing. And, you know, to some extent, it has to get worked out. I mean, older people are more at risk of the coronavirus than younger people, and older people are people, the ones who teach. And so it's a very tricky situation. It's a very tricky situation. And not knowing, I think, is the scariest part of the whole thing.
We've got an Environmental Bond Act coming up. Should people vote for it?
Well, I mean, there is one little caveat is that when they passed it, they allowed the administration basically to decide if it's going to be on the ballot or not. And I don't know if they've made that official determination. Maybe you've heard that. I think the answer is yes. The state needs the money for lots of different environmental projects all across the state. The state's not going to have a lot of resources due to its financial problems. We just think that the one way to improve upon the Bond Act would be to make sure that it's the oil, gas, and coal companies that are paying for it, not the taxpayers. The whole point of the Bond Act is supposed to be in response to dealing with climate change. And the reason we have the problems in climate change is because those companies burned fossil fuels and pumped it into the atmosphere, and also in public relations campaigns telling everybody not to worry about it. So we think they should be on the hook for paying for it. But by and large, if that question's on the ballot, we're going to urge a vote yes.
Let me say, third parties in New York State are in some danger. The Working Families Party, for example, I have been opining against the governor and the legislature making it much more difficult for them to get on the ballot and stay on the ballot in terms of the number of signatures they need or voters that they need in the last election. So what are you hearing? Is there any sense that they can survive, for example, the Working Families Party?
Well, you know, when you look at the enrollment patterns, the Working Families Party has very few people actually enrolled in it as a political party. And as you just pointed out, I mean, the way that you get automatically on the ballot is by how many votes are cast for your candidate for governor. And up until this year, you had to get at least 50,000 votes for your candidate for governor. And since New York allows candidates to run on multiple political party lines, that's how the Working Families Party could often get on the ballot on the liberal side, and the Conservative Party would get it on the more conservative side. The law that's been changed basically raises the threshold to, I believe, 120,000. I'm not 100% sure about the number because it's a formula in terms of getting automatic access to the ballot. And your top candidate for governor and for president has to meet it. So raising the bar like that on the minor political parties is going to be very significant for them, a barrier to meet, and you know whether or not they can do it. I mean, who knows? This has never been tested before. Raising the number for the gubernatorial ballot is going to be hard enough, but to add to it that you have to also meet that for president doubles at least the amount of work that the minor political parties are going to have to do to maintain their ballot status in New York.
So if anybody's listening to this, Blair Horner, and they want to help out the Working Families Party, what would they have to do? If they were going to vote against Trump on the Democratic Party, they'd have to do it on the Working Families Party, right?
That's right. That's right. That's right. They'd have to vote for however the minor political parties advances their nominees. That's the way to help the minor parties. If you believe that the minor parties are something you want to help, that's the way you would do it. It's all about how many votes they get in the presidential year and in a gubernatorial year. And that if they perform adequately, they have automatic ballot status in New York.
So let's go directly to some other politics. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez comes up with a fairly liberal group of people who have been endorsing liberals. We see Elliot Engel, a stalwart of the Democratic Party, probably losing in his Democratic primary. I've always believed that, when the character of the district changes, when the demographics change, so does the congressman. What do you think?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, ethnicity and race are far more powerful motivating factor for voters than ideology. You combine that with those changes with an intense political environment where For example, the behavior of the president, I think, exacerbates tensions in the country and forces people to become more more partisan in how they look at things. And I think what you saw in the Engel race is some reaction to both the president, a reaction to the changing demographics of the district, and the fact that Engel had been there a long time and he made mistakes. It's not only Engel, though. I mean, there were five members of the assembly that are in trouble right now, depending on what happens with the mail-in ballots that we talked about earlier. And so that doesn't happen that often, where incumbents get beat on any kind of scale. And so something's going on, particularly downstate and in the city, in the suburbs. Something's going on where people feel an intense, Democrats have an intense feeling toward demand for change is being harnessed by certain candidates, and it's leading to candidates such as like Engel, who's been in the Congress now for a long time and has a powerful position, to possibly getting beat. But it also has affected very liberal assembly members who were perceived as just being part of the political party apparatus, and insurgents may have beaten them. So there's something intense going on. I think it's partly to do, though, with what's happening in the country, both with regard to the president and with regard to the police tactics that we saw in Minneapolis and in other places. It's just charged the environment and I think put incumbents in certain areas at a distinct disadvantage.
So on the police question, there are people calling for defunding of police departments. Has Neipperg got a position on this, or what are you hearing from the young people that you deal with?
Well, the slogan defund the police is extremely popular with young people today. And as you saw in New York City, they made some big budget changes to the New York City Police Department, which, you know, is significant. Whether or not it's enough for activists, I don't know. But what does defund the police mean? I mean, some people believe it really is. You get rid of the police entirely and come up with some new sort of public safety apparatus. And for other people, it's just take money away from them. And from other people, it's just demilitarize them. So while the slogan has broad appeal, the policy underneath it is not so clear to me what it is that people want. And my guess is it's pretty fractured. So at the moment, it's a slogan. There's a lot of different things that are happening underneath. Among young people, it is definitely a popular articulation of what should happen. But it's not so clear to me what would be the policies that would meet that slogan. I mean, words matter. Defund the police means defund the police.
And that's what it means to me.
It's not clear, though, when people say it, do they mean get rid of them entirely? There are some that do believe that, but it's not clear to me that that's the case for most of the people that say that. They mean something else.
Blair Horner, talk to me about the 2020 census. Now, we know that New York could lose an extra congressman if everybody doesn't come to the door. And yet a lot of people aren't coming to the door because they're afraid the ICE people or the feds people might be on the other side. How do you rectify that?
Yeah, no, it's a real problem. The census is going to be a real problem for New York. It always is. And the state, particularly the city of New York, had taken real steps to concretely improve their census count by targeting those areas that typically have low count communities. You can usually tell they are people that are lower income often, or communities that have new Americans in them, or undocumented immigrants. The pandemic makes everything a million times worse. You're right that people are concerned about ICE, but it's also the pandemic. I mean, normally the census has already gone out and begun to knock on doors with people that haven't responded to the online questionnaire or have called it in, and they haven't even started going on the doors yet. And the census has asked for another extension from the Congress for their deadline. So it's not entirely – it's going to be a real problem, I think, in terms of getting an accurate count. And it could cost New York an additional congressional seat if the count is inadequate for the state of New York. The political power of the state will be harmed by the census. It's not harmed by the census, it's harmed by the stagnant population. But an undercount could harm the state even more.
So, Blair Horner, talk to me about ethics reform, real ethics reform. Is this ever going to happen or is it never going to happen?
Well, hope springs eternal, Alan. I'm an optimist. I like to keep banging away on these issues. It's very hard to make something that's independent, truly independent of the political class. And this entity that should exist is one that would be regulating the behavior of the political class, and they're loath to let something truly independent do that. Now, the state has something called the Commission on Judicial Conduct, which is an independent entity created in the state constitution that oversees judges. We think something like that should be in place for the executive and legislative branches, as well as the lobbying community. We're hopeful. We have powerful support in both houses. We're hopeful we can push something like that through, but it hasn't happened, and people don't like to have something truly independent watching over their shoulder.
That's right. Now, has the governor tipped his hand to you? I got to remember to ask
but
about that.
Yeah, I mean, he should support it, but it would oversee him. And the way that the legislation has been introduced by Senator Liz Krueger in the Senate, Senator Assemblymember Robert Carroll in the Assembly, it's a constitutional amendment. So technically, the governor wouldn't have to approve it if both houses of the legislature agreed and passed it through.
But his moral suasion, his ability to get people to support such a thing.
You're right. He could certainly create, if he wasn't supportive, he could create problems in the legislative process. If he was supportive, he could help. And then ultimately, if it's a constitutional amendment, it goes to the voters. And the governor has a powerful bully pulpit when it comes to arguing to people how people should vote on a particular question.
Do you see this governor running for president at any point?
Well, every governor of the state of New York thinks he or she should, whether Urban he's, should. Whether or not he'll get the opportunity may be determined by what happens this fall.
Wait. You mean George Pataki? You said every governor? George Pataki thought he could
I said every governor. It's a big state. It's a complicated state. They all have in their head. Given the right circumstances, they have a shot.
Ay, ay, ay. Okay, well, anyway, I love talking to Blair Horner of NYPIRG. He is the guy who knows more about New York State politics than anybody I know. And, Blair, you're always welcome here. And as you can see, you're always here. So so we love having you, and thank you so much for being with us.
Great. Thanks for having me. And everyone should support WAMC.